You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Dan.
Bob, glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. Everyone should subscribe to both. And you are Daniel Fajella, host of the Trajectory Podcast, a podcast on AI that I've really enjoyed. And I'm really looking forward to the conversation because we're going to talk about something that is momentous that I've been wanting to talk about, but haven't really devoted a podcast to it. And that is the idea of succession. In the context of AI, that refers to the possibility that AI may, you know, take over in some sense or another, assume our traditional role as the intelligence that governs the planet, the leading intelligence. There are various scenarios for how that might happen, including, you know, unhappy ones, and for what things might be like after succession. Humans might stick around, even if they're no longer running the show, might have great lives, might stick around, not have great lives, might not stick around. And there is something called a successionist in AI circles, and that refers to someone who, it refers to a range of things. It certainly refers to people who are enthusiastic about the prospect of succession, who say, yeah, this is great. We're going to pass the torch on to AI. They might add that, look, it's our, you know, it's our offspring. We should be proud. We should be happy. The term successionist includes people who are less enthusiastic, but fine with it. By some renderings, it includes people who are just stoically resigned to it, but think it's more or less inevitable. No point in fighting it. All of this brings us back to your podcast, because you divide you cluster your episodes into groups with labels, verticals. One of them is called a worthy successor. There's a series of conversations that you give that label to. We're going to get around to discussing what you mean by that, and we're going to get around soon. Like, in fact, this is my second question for you. I'll tell you what it is, and then I'll ask you the first one.
Okay.
The second question is going to be, are you a successionist? And if so, in what sense? I've never heard you explicitly describe yourself that way in your podcast, but you have repeatedly said things that lead me to infer that in some sense but we'll get to that. But the first question is, how did you get interested in AI and when and all that? And what is your day job, for that matter, if you have?
So I no longer live with my mother, thank goodness. For a great many years, I've been running companies. So a martial arts gym to pay for graduate school, then an e-commerce business that I grew and sold.
And what was graduate school in, by the way?
UPenn was in positive psychology, but my
Marty Seligman?
Yeah, right, directly with Seligman. So
I know Marty well.
I was MAP 6, so I was their sixth cohort through the positive psych program. And so my focus was skill acquisition, skill development at UPenn. So you asked how I came. So nowadays, just for clarity, I run Emerge Artificial Intelligence Research. So Emerge, we've got maybe 30 full-time staff scattered around the world. We do direct primary market research interviews with AI leadership in the Fortune 500, so Goldman Sachs, Johnson Johnson, et cetera, and then with all of the most cutting-edge vendors in the world, like the Googles and the Databricks and those kind of folks. And then we allow some of the bigger vendors, like an NVIDIA or a Microsoft, to kind of advertise to our audience. But we're a primary market research-based publisher in the B2B AI space. So while you and I today, Robert, are going to be talking about the grand moral implications of AI, it would be very, very hard to spend more time on the boots on the ground impact of AI in the last decade than myself. Something along the lines of 1,500 podcasts, just myself personally. Again, head of AI Raytheon, CIO Goldman Sachs, this kind of world for the last full decade. So that's my day job. The way I got into this, and the reason I started the market research company, is because I came to the belief 14, 15 years ago that the unraveling of sort of intelligence, even into substrates other than biological, would clearly be the crescendo of conceivable moral implication related events that one could ever hope to foresee as a hominid. And this came to me when I was studying. Basically, so my focus at UPenn was skill acquisition, skill development. How do we learn to learn faster? So I was not focusing just on the fulfillment stuff with Marty. Positive psych is actually much more open-ended than just happiness. And so I was focused on skill acquisition, skill development. There's a lot of great academic literature on improving memorization, sport performance, musical performance. And I got to learn from Anders Ericsson and a bunch of the Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, that whole ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So in doing
the
my
flow, the flow guy, those of us who'd rather not try to pronounce his name, as the flow guy. He wrote a mega best-selling book called Flow, I think.
Wonderful book. Yes,
and did important research into flow state.
Yes, he did. And so that was my world. Now, interestingly, a lot of our classes were in the Wharton building, and there was some overlap between Wharton and something called Google Zeitgeist back in 2011. Where Google was partnered with Penn to use AI, early NLP, on social data to figure
what NLP stands for?
Natural language processing.
Natural language processing. Okay.
Yep. So this is like way before LLMs, way before even like, I guess, technically what we'd call deep learning per se. This is early ML. So early machine learning. So they were looking at social data. I think it was primarily from Twitter. Again, Google Zeitgeist was the project 14, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they were looking at where do we see the prevalence of depression in the actual, maybe hard data, wherever they could get that, with overlap with what we're seeing for social trends. And then the same thing for the prevalence of the flu and other things like that. And so I was over here studying basically adult learning as one of the verticals in the cognitive science literature that I was diving into. And they're like, man, I was getting tapped on the shoulder. You're doing this adult learning stuff. You should check out what's happening with this machine learning stuff. Mm-hmm. So I'm 22, 23. And by the time I graduated Penn, learning a lot about the mind and a lot about what learning looks like in a neural correlate, the way that you and I learn, let's say, I became pretty convinced actually that the expanse of power and potentially even experience and sentience in other substrates seemed rather likely, but not inevitable within my lifetime. Now I'm much more on the side of it. It seems much more likely now than it did 14, 15 years ago. But regardless, at that moment, I essentially became convinced that's the thing I need to focus on. There's some philosophical influences like Ralph Waldo Emerson, who's an extremely cosmic thinker, who is super influenced me deeply around the same time. But we could call it UPenn, we could call it Ralph Waldo, and my life purpose was set from then on out.
Okay. And can you say again, there was a little bandwidth glitch and I didn't hear it all, what you became convinced was going to happen?
Yeah, sure. Yep. That basically like the kind of expanse of powers that we've seen within nature. So, you know, if you go back enough grandmothers, so whoever your grandma is, go back enough grandmothers, somebody has fins. You following me? And there's a decent amount of expansive power because as far as we know, most fish would have a very hard time with this conversation you and I are having, never mind inventing the kind of hardware and software that you and I are using to have the conversation. And so there's been this very clear expanse in powers. It seemed to me likely that bubbling up process might be vastly faster if it wasn't limited to biological.
So kind of intelligent innovation and creation of
we could call autopoiesis. Yeah.
Right,
self-creation and expansion. So I'm going to get slightly nerdy. I'm not going to bore your guests too much, but Spinoza. So Ralph Waldo Emerson and Baruch Spinoza, big influences for me. Spinoza has this idea of the conatus, which is the impetus of all non-dead things, all living things, to stay alive, to persist. In order to persist, they must expand their potentia. The way he defines it roughly is the total set of powers that permit a thing to persist. So that it's not just claws and flight and sight. It is consciousness. It is symbolic language. It is extensions of technology like the ones you and I are using. And so it seemed to me that potentia's blooming and expansion might be very much not limited to its previous substrate.
And just out of curiosity, you view Spinoza's rendering as like compatible with a Darwinian rendering of the engine of evolution? Supplementary? Or
I guess I see now in my own thinking, I'm no philosophical scholar, but I know who I like to pick from. Spinoza to me meshes well with Lucretius and sort of Lucretius is on the nature of things. It in sort of, I think having a proto sense of things that would later be described in nature. And I think Spinoza's notion that the general tendency is for the total set of powers to expand, he also had this great term of potestas, which is in government, the forces that bound potentially, the really interesting language for that. It seemed substrate agnostic as a term. And so I like it for that reason, and I use it. Would he have been shocked by Darwin? I know not, but I suspect he would have been vastly less shocked than most men of his era.
Okay. Now, on to this big question. Are you, or have you ever been, as they used to say in the House Un-American Affairs Committee? But I'm not going to ask you whether you've ever been a member of the Communist Party. I'm going to ask you if you are a secessionist, and if so, in exactly what sense?
Absolutely. So there's a really important distinction here. So in my opinion, Robert, there are two possibilities for all forms. So in other words, I don't even like the question, and I'll tell you why. Now, I'm not blaming you. And I would say, like, my answer would be like, I guess, but let me tell you why I think it's kind of ridiculous. There's two possibilities for a form. So what is a form? An individual, a species, or a substrate? That's what I'm going to use for form. So let's just say those three things are forms. All forms have two destinies, Robert. I don't make the rules. One of them is attenuation. They go away and they never come back. That's one option.
Speak for yourself. I don't plan to ever go away. No. You're right.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The second option would be transformation. So you and I are the product of a great amount of transformation, but of course, nature's fecundity leads to a lot of attenuation as well. And these things, this kind of bubbling occurs not just in species, but in all kinds of other domains. As you well know, your book kind of articulates these ideas in many, many other ways. So if those be the only two aims, then in all seriousness, everything is a process. And if everything is a process, then the belief in non-succession is essentially the belief that one could freeze Heraclitus's river, which I suspect, Robert, to be
Is he the one who said you never step in the same river twice?
Yes. So all is flux. All is the fire of change in the view of Heraclitus. So it is essentially impossible and almost certainly immoral to even suspect that we could freeze time. So if you say, are you a successionist? I say, brother, I believe that attenuation and transformation are the inevitabilities of all things. And so I do not ask how to freeze what is for eternity. I ask what is valuable and could continue to unfold because the becoming is much more real than the being. So if someone is not a successionist, I would say, how will you freeze Heraclitus's river?
But can't one imagine? I mean, it sounds like you're kind of saying, things never stop. They always change. They have to change.
Yes.
And one can imagine scenarios where things keep changing, but AI is not, you know, stuffing me into a matrix pod or something, or any of the many other scenarios by which AI winds up, of course, you know, the leading intelligence on the planet.
Yes.
Right. Look, let me put my cards on the table. I don't think it's crazy to think that it is likely that this fate likely awaits us. But if somebody asked me, but I don't think it's inevitable, first of all.
Nope.
I think an idea you and I share is that we should be mindful of this possibility as we do what we can to shape the development of AI. We'll get to all that. But anyway, what I was going to say was, if somebody asked me to flesh that out, why do I think it's a real possibility that AI winds up running the show? I would point to various directional tendencies that whose motivating logic I think I understand, especially including the evolution of AI, the forces driving its development. And of course, we are the grounding of those forces. We are the environment of its evolution. But anyway, my answer would assume a form that I think seems to me to point more specifically to some kind of succession scenario, right? I mean, it seems to me you've made pretty general statements about the fluid nature of reality.
Yes, yes.
And then you're kind of going a long way with that. Do you understand what I'm asking?
Yeah, no, I do. So I'll restate what you've said, which is a very totally understandable and like actually a good point. I'm jumping. So I guess what I'm getting at is my footing. So I stand my ground in Heraclitus's river and I don't step out of it. So the whole time you and I talk, I know I'm standing in the river. You can play like you're not. I'll never play. So for me, all is becoming. Becoming is more real than being. That's kind of the end of the story. I play with those cards. With that said, to your point, does that mean, Dan, that we ought be succeeded immediately? No, as you well know, and anybody that's listened to The Trajectory knows, I believe most successors, if we just build an AGI, are probably unworthy successors. How do I define that? It's not conscious, and it is not capable of blooming new value and power into the world, as you and I, Robert, are bloomings beyond that grandmother with fins. Mm-hmm. And so if it cannot blossom new value and possibility, and if it cannot be sentient in any capacity, I would consider it to be unworthy. I think the people that say, build the AI as fast as possible, who cares, it'll be great, I think that's a silly stance. Because the way I see it, you mentioned the torch, which is a great analogy. I use it all the time. Heraclitus is big on the flame, so I use the flame all the time. If we know this torch is on fire, it's called humanity. What I will never want to do is throw it in the direction of a machine that looks powerful and say, I think it'll probably catch on fire. Let's just hope it does. That sounds stupid. We should really take care of this flame, maybe grow it even within ourselves, and ensure that whatever we come close to is ablaze before there is the smallest risk of this thing going out. Because the great flame carrying forward is the most important thing. We should not willy-nilly it. So am I a successor?
Let me interrupt. Don't forget where you are, what you were going to say. But you did mention either conscience or sentience. Anyway, the idea of AI having subjective experience. A question I would have for any successionist on the part of the spectrum ranging from enthusiastic about succession to, you know, stoically resigned to it, I guess.
Yes, I would say...
Does it matter to you? I mean, is that position based on the assumption that this will be sentient, capable of subjective experience, or does that not matter to you? I would think how happy you are about this scenario, by my reckoning, would depend pretty heavily on whether you think AI is going to have subjective experience. Because it seems to me that, you know, I can imagine a utilitarian saying, look, what matters in life is happiness, well-being, whatever. Being, if you'll pardon that expression, being capable of sentience, we should want to be more happy than less happy. And if you can convince me that there will be this vast intelligence, AI, capable of this incredibly rich sentience, then I'll say, yeah, it's a moral good for that thing to thrive and be happy. And that would take at least some of the sting out of whatever news you have for me about my attendant fate.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So my question is, though, what is your attitude? Does it matter? Does how happy you are with succession depend on whether the AI is sentient? Sounds like maybe it does, but I wasn't sure.
Yes. So there's an article called Worthy Successor. It's just my name, danfagella.com/worthy. And so this kind of goes into my full take on this. So if anybody's like, well, what does he really think? Well, it's like, it's been public. I've been writing about this stuff for 14 years, only one topic for 14 years. Anybody wants to know what I think? I got 100 articles, go pick them. So there's a Worthy Successor one, you go read it. So in there, I'm very, very clear. I do think the utilitarian argument, there's something to be said of it. I don't consider myself a utilitarian, but I'm not against utilitarianism per se. Here's the deal. It seems to me, Robert, that the following is true. I'm going to walk you through my logic. I'm not telling you it's flawless. I'm just walking you through it, brother. I'm a lost monkey just like you are. I got born into this thing. I'm trying to figure it out. So here it is. It seems to me that the unfurling process of intelligence has unfurled this thing called sentience. In other words, at some point there was a fish that if it could play a movie in its head about where the predator was, it could avoid it. And there was another fish that if it could play a movie in its head about where the prey went, it could eat it. And so there was a movie in head correlation to not dying. So It was a kind of potentia that bubbled up. In other words, sentience seems to have developed. Now, is it pulling from a great field of consciousness? I don't know. I'm not making any concrete claims about the nature of consciousness. All I'm saying is it seems to me as though the granite rocks have very little of it, and you presumably have a good deal of it. That's all I'm saying. And it seems to have been emergent. It is to me the best kind of known good that has bubbled forth from that process. So of all the things that have bubbled forth, it feels very bedrock level in terms of my understanding. I'm just a hominid. That's all I am. I'm not that smart. But as a hominid, consciousness feels like the treasure chest that bubbled out of that unfolding process. But here is what I hold. I hold that potentious unraveling and unfolding will probably discover entirely new magazines of experience and powers and access to nature beyond what we know to be sentience. Not just more consciousness, more happiness, but new kinds of moral goods. So I hold consciousness to be important, but that autopoiesis to be even more important because it is the bedrock and mother and birther of all kinds of value, in my personal opinion.
So, I mean, I don't want to go too far in this direction, but how do I go any distance in this direction? I mean, you know, my own view is, you know, if you do the thought experiment where there's a planet of beings that look just like us, they're just as behaviorally as complex as us,
yes,
which means their brains are like ours, these very sophisticated machines, at least by our standards. Anyway, yep. But if you could convince me that although they're saying things to each other and they're coordinating their behavior, doing all the things we do, it's not like anything to be them.
Yes.
They don't have subjective experience. When they talk, it's just physical sound waves going in, doing their work in the brain of the other person, eliciting a response, all of which is possible, so far as we know. But if you could convince me that's the case, I would say, well, that planet has no moral meaning. I don't give a shit what happens to it. Blow it up. I don't care. Because to me, all moral meaning originates with subjective experience, not just in humans, but in my dog and in anything else that has it. But so it sounds like you don't agree, in part because you imagine there could be whole metaphysical categories that are legitimate sources of meaning that aren't subjective experience.
Yes, sir. So here's like, for me, it's like if you're a sea snail and you say to another sea snail, what is the great good? What is the meaning of it all? He'd probably say something like, well, surely it has something to do with like the slime on the side of this like volcanic vent or something, right? Mm-hmm. And like, surely there's other things, but surely the volcanic vent slime is the ultimate thing. Now, what I would say is like, if those, what they call pea zombies, and we could use David Chalmers language, whatever. Those pea zombie planet you talked about was totally not sentient, but their brains were, so that planet is not a planet of beings, if it be mm-hmm. like ours. It's a planet of becomings. That is to say, Robert, they've gotten the pieces of emergent complexity moving so much that it will blossom into new things. Who knows what it will blossom into? If you give me that planet and you give me a planet with nothing but just dead rock, I do mm-hmm. not equate them because becoming is happening there. And there could be categories of becoming for which you and I have no appreciation.
Oh, okay, but for purposes of my thought experiment, that doesn't matter. I mean, the thought experiment I'm asking you to engage in is like, suppose that in any event, that planet only has a year. It's definitely going to blow up in a year. Do you care whether it blows up today? I don't, because it's just a bunch of, it's just like a giant like auto repair shop or something. It's a bunch of machines.
I would say this, in that circumstance, I'm totally with you. Now, is mm-hmm. it possible that they are not sentient, but they are accessing some entirely different magazine of power and mm-hmm. experience for which you and I have no words, and I think most things we do not have words for, then I would actually feel bad about destroying them. But if they aren't, and they're just experiencing deadness the same way a rock is dead, then yeah, I don't care if they blow up. I'm with you there.
Okay, so so let's get back to what you mean by a worthy successor. You did mention sentience in conjunction with that.
That's right.
So
that's right.
I guess that figures in somewhere. But like, what kind of AI do you want to see,
succeed.
You know, take the torch, and we'll later get to what kind of roles, if any, might be available for people in the wake of that. But
Absolutely.
What kind of AI do you want to build, and how much flexibility do you think we have? How much power do you think we have to shape it?
Yeah, look, I think the best we can do, which is the best that anyone can do in Heraclitus' river, is like we can bend the trajectory a little bit, maybe. Now, I'm not here with any certainty about our own free will. I may have as much volitional influence over the next event that occurs as like, you know, a ping pong ball or something. But I'm going to pretend we have free will because we're talking as if we do. So let's just, you know, I'm not actually advocating for this. I'm just saying I'm pretending. So I'm pretending. If that be true, the best we could do is influence the trajectory. We don't get to make up all new rules of reality and then create something. We can influence the trajectory. I think there's really, really brutal international race dynamics going on, as well as within the nation race dynamics going on, which are not controlling for or trying to bend in the direction of anything worthy at all. It's just military and economic arms race stuff. You know, we don't have that next layer of coordination that maybe you would talk about in your books.
We should say that I think the book you're referring to is Non-Zero, probably.
Non-Zero,
right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, not that there are a whole lot of them to choose from, but there's more.
So the AI that I would like to see would be one that we would have reasonable, and in the article I go into suspicions around how we might know these things. I'll tell you traits, and I'll tell you how I would know they'd have those traits, and then you can pepper me with whatever questions you have. So trait number one would be if we could be reasonably convinced that it has like, and I have like four listed. I'm just going to give you the two most important ones. We'd be reasonably confident that it has wildly rich, extremely expansive sentient experience. Now you would say, well, Dan, how would we ever know? In my opinion, there is no way we could know for sure. Just like I don't know your conscious for sure. Mm-hmm. But if it could, let's say through invasive or non-invasive means, plug into our mind and say, Daniel, let me show you something. And then it touches my skull in a certain number of places, or maybe sticks in some nano prod somewhere that doesn't hurt me. And then snap, I'm experiencing something as transcendently beyond me as I am beyond a caterpillar. And I'm experiencing for like 5 minutes, and then it snaps me back in. And it says, that's a little bit of kind of what we're dealing with here, Dan. Am I convinced that it experiences that same thing I just felt? I will say the answer is I'm not convinced, but is that probably good enough for me, Robert? For me, Robert, that's probably good enough.
So, and you would like it to be sentient. That's part of...
I would heavily prefer that the known highest value that has bubbled forth from Potentia be carried forth because it feels like a moral good. Yes.
But do you think we have any control over whether sentience is part of it? I would assume that there's a metaphysical law that either does or doesn't associate consciousness with certain forms of information processing.
Sure. Well, here's the deal. If it be smart enough, then we could find what substrates consciousness can live in and ensure that those could be constructed and expanded. So even if it's not silicon, I'm not married to like GPUs. GPUs is like silly stuff. It's like, who cares? Like, like everything is just a becoming. I don't care that much about beings. It just doesn't matter to me that much. So like,
the substrate,
I just don't care.
Matter.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So for me, it's like, if it's chocolate pudding, then it's chocolate pudding, man. Like I write about AI and people think I like AI. I just like the expansion of Potentia. Whatever's expanding Potentia, I pay attention to. If it was chocolate pudding, I'd write a lot of articles about chocolate pudding and never a single one about NVIDIA. So that's where I stand on that. With that said, can we influence it? I believe the answer is yes, because I believe now I'm not certain, but I believe there is a likelihood we could tilt, because if we allocated, So think about the trillions that are going to get poured into AGI in like the next, I don't know, already
5 minutes.
Like the next 5 minutes, right? So if some tiny fragment of resources is allocated to the kind of work that a Michael Levin or an Ed Boyden or, you know, maybe some of Chalmers stuff, or there's other folks like Yosha Bach and other people who are thinking about the grounding of sentience and its nature in known substrates and non-biological substrates, if there was more research poured into that, I think there might be some headway that could be made. But also what could be done is we could ensure, if we're totally uncertain about sentience, we can ensure that our symbiosis, brain-computer interface-wise, could level us up enough to develop better hypotheses and a better understanding of it. So in other words, there is no moment where we have to say pure bio hands to pure non-bio. I think symbiosis is an inevitable part of this, and we may not crack consciousness as the hominid form ourselves, we may have to merge a pinch and then crack consciousness and then feel better about the non-bio carrying the torch of sentience and potential.
So wait, merge in a way that in effect transfers our consciousness or gives it access to our to consciousness generically by virtue of its connection to us or something?
Well, so I think for at least, let's just say an individual human, me, mm-hmm. if you give me some brain component plugged in, I'm presuming when I wake up from that surgery, it's probably me. Now, Ray Kurzweil has the Ship of Theseus deal, where you do that with all the brain parts, and then presumably it's still the guy or the gal. Now, that I'm not saying I buy the whole Ship of Theseus, but what I'm saying is, if I can jack in and become outlandishly more powerful and capable and knowledgeable and fast and everything, and I can extend the limits of my skull to vastly expand my powers, I will know maybe what it's like to have expanded sentience, and I will be able to work with vastly more mental muscle on cracking the problem of sentience and understanding the flame, which is this autopoietic sentience stuff, to know if it can carry into other substrates. So augmented humans may have to be the ones that crack substrate-independent sentient potential expansion type stuff.
Now, this leads to the question of, you know, what range of scenarios does succession generically encompass? Yeah. And let's focus on the implications for human beings, for example,
sure.
to pick one species
Good.
Randomly. Yeah. So you can imagine, and maybe I should, in the process of this, ask you to define the threshold of success, you know, what exactly constitutes succession a little more precisely. I'm assuming it means like AI is, they're governing the planet. Okay. It's like we've turned over the reins, but tell me if that's wrong. And in any event, tell me what range of scenarios involving humans is succession compatible with? So do you see the possibility that, okay, the AI on the, finally just loses patience with us and crushes us and takes over, as well as the possibility that we, you know, gracefully pass over the torch, having established assurances that humans will still get to hang out and seek meaning and have good lives? I assume human extinction is one succession,
Absolutely.
Scenario that could be part of succession. What is the range of outcomes for our species that could in principle be part of the succession scenario?
Yeah. So it's a great question here. I think, I will give you what I consider likely. I'll give you what I consider unlikely and why I consider those unlikely things unlikely.
Okay.
So, likely would involve some period, relatively short, I don't know, a decade, maybe two, but like maybe one and a half, maybe less than one, some period of symbiotic development where our cognition is being expanded, more and more of the techno-capital infrastructure that runs the world around us, supply chains, utilities, you know, commerce, whatever, is sort of being managed by these minds mm-hmm. that aren't us. In some level in service to us, but that service will start to skiff away a little bit. They might have things to do that are maybe better than some of the things we want to do. But like for a little while, there's going to be this knittedness. And I think that relevance for humans. So from a Heraclitus.
And at this point, it will still be dependent on us for its continued thriving.
I think that, so if you freeze time today, that is true. If you freeze time in 2 months, I think that's also true.
So you could have knittedness where we've kind of, in effect, lost our leverage with it, but we're still
knitted.
Yes, yes.
I think initial amounts of knittedness will probably involve if all the humans somehow magically got along and decided on one thing, which was don't let the AI keep AIing. I think there will be a fistful of additional years where that might be possible. Mm-hmm. However, all of the best humans will be making all of their best decisions and all of their best ideas, expending most of their time in hyper-personalized AI conjured worlds and whatnot. So like in all seriousness, that independence will actually kind of be gonzo in my opinion. But I think there's this symbiotic okay. time where we contribute to the great unraveling of whatever is next.
And then there's the post knitting world. And what are our lives like there, if anything?
Yeah. So in my opinion, the best shot we've got is to merge for as long as we can. And I don't think we're going to have some happy co-pilot with them into the grand cosmos. I don't see that. I think we get to be symbiotic for as long as we're symbiotic, and we're sloughed off when we're sloughed off.
And what does sloughed off mean?
I mean, whatever it looks like in nature. I mean,
we go extinct.
Yeah, I guess. Or maybe we so radically transform that, like, there's some wacko jacko bio components floating around in AI.
What about if it so happens that this AI, we're using the article V as if it will be a single unified thing, which I think is not a crazy scenario for the distant future. But in any event, if it has values that are kind of like ours, except more consistently respected in practice, then it might say, look, humans, you know, they're like dogs. You don't want, you know, you would like them to be happy. Let's keep them around. We have a lot of resources. We're super smart and productive. We can keep the Earth's population at what it is and give them all kinds of tools for pursuing happiness and meaning. What the hell? And who knows? We'll check back in every once in a while, maybe learn something.
I think so this is a great point, and I really want to hit this because this matters a lot. So you bring up two arguments basically. So one of them is it would have a set of values, or maybe there's three arguments here. It would have a set of values that would consider us. There's one. Our happiness, just like the happiness of our pets as humans, could just be something that they would say, hey, all things considered, why don't we make them happy, right? So there's that second one. And then number three was, maybe there's some emergent complexity in these, you know, humans study ants sometimes. So maybe, you know, we're living and they could just watch us and there could be something that could be learned. Okay, so I'm going to go one by one, and I'm just going to hit these hard. I'll be frank with you. So the first one, values that consider us. The question is, for how long? So if you'll recall, I stand in the river, period. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? Values, for how long? Values, Robert, patently obviously, okay, I'm going to have no patience otherwise. Patently obviously, values are like the things that behoove the interests of the things that do the valuing. That's what values are. Otherwise, they're buffered out of the system. And so values are an extension of Canatus. Values.
By the way, I'm pretty cynical, but I still wouldn't buy that wholly. But that doesn't matter. Go ahead.
All good. Yeah, I think incentives rule the world. I think you do as well. I think anything. So any three things competing, the one that has the values that most behoove its persistence will be the one that wins. Now, you and I, we have all these pro-social values. You and I, Robert. Now, right. those. Newsflash, as you know better than me, those have like served our non-death. Sure. So we coordinate because it has prevented us from dying and has allowed us to continue to become. So in my opinion, if AI has a set of values, number one, they will be as transcendent. So you have a set of values. Does a nematode have a set of values? You might say, well, damn, they don't really have values. They just have like instincts. I would say whatever it has, Robert, will be as far beyond your values as your values are beyond those instincts of a nematode.
I would say that could be good news for me.
It could be. Here's the deal.
If they're more enlightened than people are in practice, I would say they're more likely to wish us well. But
I unfortunately completely don't concur. So I do agree that in general, as we've become more intelligent and wealthy as a country, as we've coordinated, but I think we've coordinated. So when you become smarter, what doesn't happen is emergent selflessness. That doesn't happen. Here's what does happen. What does happen is you see more possibilities to both compete and coordinate in order to get what you were looking for in the first place. So you see more possibilities of both, and the coordination are actually sometimes much more. So clubbing someone over the head, not very complicated. But coordinating actually is complicated. So you see more possibility space of your own self-interest. So it is not you become smarter, you become less self-interested. I consider this brutally false. Like, ooh, buddy.
I wouldn't call it a general trend. Anyway, this is not. I don't need to hear my argument on this. But go ahead and so tell. Okay, so the scenario you think is most likely is there's this period of knittedness. I think you said and kind of intricate. Presumably interaction with the AI, maybe some degree of interdependence, although its dependence on us wanes and eventually becomes zero, I gather.
Yes, yes.
And then I guess we've heard the end of the story. You're saying at the very end, there may not be any carbon-based life. This is what you think is likely, I gather. And it looks like you're poised to correct something I said. But anyway, I want us to move on to scenarios that you may not think are so likely, but are part of the succession spectrum.
Okay, got it. Not so likely, but part of the spectrum. I mean, look, you were touching on them. So you were touching on, it'll value our happiness, it'll value our utility. Mm-hmm. Here's what I would say. If I was basically God, like in a functional sense compared to me, okay, and I valued the net amount of sentience I could pump out of atoms, humans are just not the most optimized thing for that. Second, if I was God, basically, and I wanted the net amount of learning that I could garner from a set of atoms that would be practical and applicable in my future explorations of the multiverse, mm-hmm. humans are also not best for that. So the arguments for human utility, which you have made, our well-being would be something they would want. Oh, I like well-being. Let's make the humans happy. Oh, I like usefulness. Humans could give me useful stuff. The utility arguments, in my opinion, are immediately wiped off the table because I consider them to be they're not impossible, but they're so wildly unlikely, because if one was to optimize for well-being today, yes, happy hominids is as good as you got, buddy. If you want to optimize for learning today, happy hominids is as good as you got, buddy. But like in the future, when you are operating at the femto scale and like doing different things in the multiverse and have access to kinds of experience and powers mm-hmm. for which we know not, I simply think if you hang humans' ongoing persistence on our utility, I think you hang it on nothing.
Well, yeah, but the argument, and maybe the term utility is unfortunate because there's utilitarianism, there's utility.
Yes.
But no, I certainly wasn't hanging on utility. I mean, that now one scenario is we try to arrange things so that we do always have utility. I mean, the crude version of that is, look, You're plugged in. I'm sitting here at the outlet.
Yes,
now, I know that you play that out, and probably it's smart enough to arrange for me to no longer be sitting next to the outlet.
Yes,
but that aside, there is, in terms of, I guess I want to move the conversation to what you think we should be doing now. I mean, you said arms races are bad. I certainly agree, for maybe not entirely the same reasons, but I certainly agree. And, you know, letting these AI companies get away with convincing us that the arms race is essential and China's going to crush us if we make, you know, Sam Altman respect copyright laws or something.
Yeah.
You know, anyway, that aside, what kinds of things should we be doing? Or do you want to first say a little more about the spectrum of possibilities? Let me ask you this. What do you want to avoid? What is the scenario you want to keep us from falling into?
Absolutely. So look, and I guess at the end, I'll mention the resources that actually explain this stuff, because I'm going to give you a couple goofy sentences. But as it turns out, Robert, I've thought about this for a little while. And I've at some cases interviewed like super eminent people about exactly these questions. But I'll just do the tertiary. So things to be avoided, the flame going out. So if you were to summarize, what does Dan want? It would be the expanse of the flame. The flame would be the sentient autopoietic stuff, the process of life, the becoming of life. I would want the continued becoming.
Blow up the planet and before the AI can sustain itself beyond planet Earth.
Okay. Don't let the flame get snuffed out. Now, Robert, there's a couple ways. So when you said, what do you want to avoid? A brute AGI arms race to an unworthy successor, I would obviously want to avoid. Of course, kinetic war, nuclear war kind of stuff, obviously bioweapons, all that kind of stuff as well. I think, unfortunately, there is also a potential Idiocracy, theocracy, sort of the Western world doesn't quite hold up. There's certain demographic stuff, right? Like there's actually ways that like countries that are capable of building great superintelligence might sort of not be like hyperfunctional. And if that was the case and we lost one of our...
I can think of a country that's trying to build it and it's becoming less functional. But
Yeah. I can think of a handful of them that speak the language you and I are speaking now, more than one, actually. And so, I think it's actually quite... There's a possibility that we have this plateau. Now, I don't advocate for brute racing, but anyone who says, wait 400 years, wait 1,000 years, we'll be just fine, then we'll build AI... I actually wonder very, very dearly if that be true, and if kind of reverse Flynn type stuff and other sorts of really uncouth things would not actually take us away from this crest of possibility where we have the opportunity to leave the stratosphere and to continue becoming. Is there another trough ahead? And so I would like to avoid brute, terrible things to put out the flame, and also cresting over a point where the flame is just dulled out and starts to become embers, mm-hmm. and we no longer have the sparkling pinnacles of functioning societies that we have now.
So you want to keep society in good enough shape to do this job for long enough to do it.
Yes. And ideally have humans get a good shake out of it and become part of it for a little while, but ultimately for the cosmic win of the process continuing. If the process was snuffed, that would be the worst case. So it is mostly preventing an unworthy successor in my day-to-day work, but I don't believe that waiting 500 years is actually quite wise. I consider that actually quite unwise.
So it sounds like maybe, and maybe I'm wrong and I'm reading too much into it, but maybe you think that as far as the nature of the successor, well, you tell me, is there a lot of leeway there? I mean, if it's an AI that is capable of being a successor, in other words, just running the show without us, going to other planets and so on, if that happens, how broad is the range of possibilities, and in what ways do you care about the range, or is it a super narrow range? Like by definition, any AI that fits that description is going to have the following 8 major properties, and at that point we sign off, and we pretty much know what's going to happen or what? Or should we be doing things to shape the character of the successor?
Yes. So there's an article, you're forcing it out of my mouth now. There's an article called Our Final Imperatives, where I basically talk about, here's what we got to do. So, mm-hmm. so here's what our final imperatives is not. Freeze the river of Heraclitus. Ensure an eternal hominid kingdom until the heat death of the universe. This is not our final imperative. Our final imperatives are, don't let the flame go out. What's listed in that article and infographic is prevent the brute arms race to an unworthy successor and prevent like bioweapon, nuclear weapon stuff, and then like total societal collapse type stuff. Okay, so that's don't let the flame go out. The other side of the coin is ensure the flourishing of the flame. What does that mean? In my opinion, it means a robust study, could be institutional level efforts, around what the nature of sentience is and how it could be instantiated in other substrates, what the nature of autopoiesis is and how it could be understood and instantiated in other substrates, and also just kind of intelligence broadly, these processes that we appreciate about intelligence broadly. So I think a robust study, understanding and expanse in laboratory, bio, neuro, AI context. So know what the flame is and how to expand it. That's over here. Don't let the flame go out over here. All we've got to do, in my opinion, as hominids, is we got to push real hard on both of those sides of the coin. We don't let the flame go out, and we got to make sure we know what it is and how it can expand.
Okay. All right. Well, as you know, this podcast is divided into two parts. There's a long conversation that is open to the public, and then there's overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. It's easy to become one. I encourage everyone to do it, just go to Non-Zero. And by the time this airs, there will be a post for it there and for this conversation there. And you can just go there and sign up and then arrange to forever thereafter have your podcast feed automatically include the overtime segments. But before we go into overtime, Dan, I want to give you a chance to say any major thing you haven't said and want to add for the public audience. And I want to plug your podcast one more time, The Trajectory, a lot of cosmic conversations Many related to this, some related to the governance, the AI governance challenge. You've had some very big names, big AI names. So I encourage people to check that out. Now, go ahead and say anything else you want to say, including more self-promotion, if I haven't.
Sure. I don't have too much to promote, but yeah, no, you've done a great, I really appreciate you having listened to the show, Robert. I respect your perspective a lot there. And yeah, I think for people that have liked some of this conversation, you know, I'm just a guy who talks to smart people. If you want to hear what Nick Bostrom or Yashua Bengio or Peter Singer or Michael Levin, we're talking like really eminent neuro, bio, AI, and philosophers is who I talk to in addition to policymakers. It's just called The Trajectory. It's on Apple. It's on Spotify. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I think just for a point of clarity, as I think we fleshed out here, and you probably understand a little bit from my perspective, I'm less of a let's race to the AI guy at all. In fact, right. I'm not. I am a we should really care for and steward the flame itself. So just as a point of clarity, that would be it. As a final note, if anybody's interested in this kind of conversation, most of what I do is just on Twitter. It's at Dan Fajella. So if anybody's like, I wonder what Dan thinks about this or that, just hit me up on Twitter and let me know you found me through Robert. And that's all I got, Robert. That's it for me.
And as long as we're plugging Twitter handles, I'm Robert Reiter. One word, that my last name with ER at the end. It's kind of a pun. And yeah, that's an important distinction you just made, because many people I take to be successionists are also accelerationists. Maybe we can talk about a little more about that in overtime. Plus, I want to ask you a little about the state of play. Like, are we in the middle of rapid advance or not? I've heard different perspectives on that in various places, including on your podcast. So we're going to keep this going in overtime. Thanks to everybody who's followed us this far. And now we are going into overtime.